Yemeni armed forces carried out two specific military operations. The first was carried out by the Missile Force and UAV Force against the U.S. aircraft carrier Truman and its affiliated vessels in the Northern Red Sea, using two cruise missiles and two drones. The second was carried out by the Naval, the UAV, and the Missile Forces, targeting the U.S. aircraft carrier Vinson and its affiliated vessels in the Arabian Sea, using three cruise missiles and four drones. The military operations have successfully achieved their objectives. The Yemeni armed forces will persist their support operations deep within the Zionist entity in occupied Palestine at an escalating pace over the coming period. They will also continue their military operations in the Red and Arabian Seas, targeting all hostile forces. Dozens of U.S. airstrikes will not deter them from their supportive stance toward the oppressed Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip until the aggression against them stops and the siege is lifted.
Well, Gaza's civil defense agency has accused the Israeli military of carrying out summary executions in the killing of 15 medical workers last month, rejecting the findings of the Israeli army's internal investigation. Mohammad Al-Mughayr, a Gaza civil defense official, has said video footage filmed by one of the paramedics disproves the Israeli military's narrative and clearly shows that the rescue workers were executed. He also accused Israel of attempting to circumvent its obligations under international law. Earlier, the Palestinian Red Crescent also dismissed the Israeli report as invalid and unacceptable, calling it misleading and full of lies. On March the 23rd, 15 Palestinian paramedics and rescue workers were shot dead by Israeli forces near Rafah in southern Gaza. UN officials and the Red Crescent found their bodies a week later in a shallow grave dug by Israeli forces. Professor Jeffrey Nice, the former ICC prosecutor and human rights barrister, says killings of Gaza medics should be investigated as a possible war crime.
There remains evidence that it may well be a war crime, and it's something that should be investigated as a possible war crime, and it should be investigated by the International Criminal Court, which is the only international court capable of conducting a criminal investigation into something like this. The report that's been produced may engender in some people the suspicion that it's a whitewash, and what Israel needs to do right now is to take steps to avoid that inference becoming a conclusion, and it can do that by supplementing what it's said so far with all the underlying necessary paper, computer, and other evidence, and not dealing with things in the broad brush way it has so far. Young man who died, an aid worker, no suggestion he was Hamas, but for that video, an entirely different, earlier, and absolutely false account would have been given about this happening to ambulances in a fire truck that had no flashing lights and that were not populated by people wearing high-visibility aid worker uniforms. We are living in a terrible age where it's possible to conduct warfare, to advance a story that is completely untrue, hope to get away with it, and then advance, asking for people to believe it, a very different version.
Well, now going back to our story on Yemen from Mr. Yahya Sari'a's statement, we're now joined from Sana'a by Mr. Hussein Al-Bukhaiti, activist and political commentator. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Bukhaiti, very much for joining me. Mr. Bukhaiti, time and time again, the Yemeni people and Yemen has proved to the world through weekly mass protests, through continued operations, no matter the continued aggression on the Arab country by the U.S., by Israel. And of course, we can't forget the U.K. just earlier this year in January were also carrying out attacks on Yemen, that they have not stopped in their firm position and support for the people of Gaza. Now, many viewers continue to ask, and many people around the world continue to ask, what or where does this firm stance and first firm belief and firm steadfastness from the Yemeni people actually come from? Mr. Bukhaiti, can you explain from a Yemeni point of view where this steadfastness and firm position come from?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Because Yemen has gone through 9 years of Saudi-led coalition war with the United Arab Emirates, and it was fully supported by the United States, and they have gone through many of this massacre that been done by the Saudi regime and United Arab Emirates, about 300,000 airstrike, a blockade, a starvation, malnutrition. So Yemeni has gone through exactly what the people in Gaza has gone through. And no one at that point stood with Yemen. Only few country like Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and Algeria, and just a handful of nation who actually supported Yemeni either politically or through the media. That's why Yemeni, because they have gone through this. For 9 years, they know what's happening in Gaza. They actually feel it, all that bloodshed and the killing and the blockade and the genocide that's actually conducted by the Israeli regime, one which is supported by the United States. It's the same enemy that's killing the Palestinian people, is the same one that was killing the Yemenis, but with a different tools. That's why, as we see today, that Yemeni army has launched a major attack, two drones targeting the Israeli or occupied Palestine, and as well several drones and cruise missiles have targeted United States aircraft carrier Vinson in the Arabian Sea, and as well Truman aircraft carrier in the north of the Red Sea. This is a clear message that those attacks that's happening against Yemen, it will not stop in Yemeni from targeting the Israeli regime, from continue to form a blockade against the Zionists in the Red Sea, and as well to protect the Yemenis by targeting those aircraft carriers.
I'd like to thank you very much there, Mr. Hussein Boukhaiti, joining us from Sana'a, activist and political commentator. A pleasure to have you with us. The Israeli military has once again killed Palestinian civilians in a so-called safe zone designated by the regime itself in the Gaza Strip. The attack hit a tent area in the Al-Mawasi near Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, killing a Palestinian couple. The regime's military also bombed the Jabalia refugee camp. The details on that attack are sketchy. Israeli airstrikes have killed at least 40 Palestinians in Gaza in a matter of 24 hours. The UN Relief Agency in Gaza has warned that Palestinian refugees are enduring, quote, unimaginable suffering there. UNRWA said nothing justifies the Israeli collective punishment of mostly children, women, and ordinary men in Gaza. The death toll from the Israeli genocide in Gaza since 2023 now exceeds 51,200, with nearly 117 others injured. Israel continues with its demolition of Palestinian homes and structures in the occupied West Bank in a bid to grab more lands. The regime forces destroyed two residential buildings in a small town west of Ramallah. Israeli bulldozers also leveled a multi-story structure in Beit Omar, north of Al-Khalil. The regime keeps demolishing Palestinian houses under the pretext of lacking Israeli-issued permits. Since the start of the regime's genocidal war on Gaza in October 2023, Israel has stepped raids and incursions into the occupied West Bank, killing and abducting hundreds of Palestinians. According to United Nations reports, over 10,000 Palestinian structures have been destroyed in the West Bank since 2009, most of them being residential buildings. This has led to the displacement of thousands of Palestinians. Well, Iran says the ongoing indirect talks with U.S. are solely focused on the removal of all unjustified and illegal sanctions imposed against the country by Washington. Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson Ismail Begai has emphasized that based on our past experiences with the JCPOA, Iran's fundamental demand in any negotiation is the complete and effective lifting of all sanctions, ensuring tangible economic benefits. He highlighted that the removal of the sanctions must allow Tehran to conduct its normal commercial and banking activities without restrictions. Begai also underscored Iran's insistence on guarantees to ensure that any agreement reached is durable and that all parties will remain committed to fulfilling their obligations. In a fresh sign of a worsening political spat between Israel and its Western allies over the Gaza onslaught, the regime has barred a group of French lawmakers and officials from entering the occupied territories. The move came amid diplomatic tensions that followed President Emmanuel Macron's announcement that France will recognize a Palestinian state in June. Israel revoked visas for 27 French lawmakers and officials just 2 days before their planned visit to the occupied Palestinian territories. The regime said the move was made under a law that permits banning individuals deemed to act against Israel. The group condemned the decision as collective punishment and a serious blow to diplomatic relations, urging Macron to consider reciprocal measures. The ban also came only days after Israel stopped two British members of parliament from governing Labour Party from entering the occupied lands. Also in February, Israel banned the entry of two left-wing European Parliament deputies. Now joining us for more on the story is Mr. Barry Grossman, political analyst, joining us there from Bali, Indonesia. I'd like to thank you very much, Mr. Grossman, for joining us. Mr. Grossman, so let's just, if we summarize it a bit. So basically, France announced it's going to recognize Palestinian state in June. In response, of course, the regime, the Israeli regime, barred a group of French lawmakers and officials from entering. And as we just heard from the report, this isn't the first time they've done this, the Israeli entity. They've done it to British MPs just a few weeks ago. They've done it to other MPs and other lawmakers from Western countries. Now, there's been a lot of criticism on this, that this is a serious blow to diplomatic relations between France and the Israeli entity. But do you see it as so? Is this indeed going to be hurting their relations?
Well, look, I'm always very skeptical. Anything that's done by any European nation vis-a-vis Israel. I think if France was genuine about supporting the Palestinian cause, it would already long ago have recognized Palestine. And certainly since this round of hostility started, would have established something of an embargo on selling, at the very least, armaments to Israel. As for this latest incident, you know, once again, France likes to sort of see itself as a lone ranger and take offense at following with what the English-speaking world is doing. Very often making arguments, taking offense that the English world is sort of out to get France. So that explains why France is taking a slightly, and I mean slightly, different position vis-a-vis the current massacres playing out in Israel. But it'd be a hard stretch to see France as being supportive of the Palestinian cause. If they want to recognize Palestine, that's great. Get on with it. I think with this incident, there's a bit of a conflation taking place in the sense that there's no need for anybody from France to go to occupied Palestine in order to give the recognition that they've been, like so many other Atlantic world nations, promising for many years. There's no need to wait a few more months. The time to do this is now, and to seek other allied nations that are willing to take the same position. Countries like Norway, I think Canada has very recently said also that they plan to recognize Palestine as a freestanding state and member of the United Nations. So I say get on with it already. And in terms of the genocidal hostilities that are playing out, take a very clear position to denounce those hostilities. On the other side of the coin, of course, Israelis like to take offense at anybody that doesn't support them wholeheartedly and without qualification. It's really quite absurd that from the beginning of these hostilities, they've taken the position that the only people they'll allow to visit the country are people that support Israel's, what it claims is its right, not only to exist, but to carry out this outrageous series of massacres and this genocide against the people of Gaza, and more generally against Palestinians, because we see the same tactics playing out in the West Bank. But there is a conflation nevertheless taking place. To be sure, in Israel's mind, it takes offense at a country like, an important country like France, stating publicly that it will recognize the existence of Palestine. How that impacts on any legitimate Israeli interest is difficult to comprehend.
Yes. Yes, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Barry Grossman. I'm so sorry to cut you off. Our time has run out during this broadcast. Mr. Barry Grossman, their political analyst, joining us from Bali, Indonesia. Pleasure to have you with us. Thank you very much for this hour's headlines. For more updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
Bismillahi r-Rahman r-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is part of the speech delivered on April 26th. 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in meeting with a number of university students and academic personalities on the 24th day of month of Ramadan. My expectation of the youths who have undertaken a managerial responsibility is to set yourselves the goal of resolving that matter. This was another point. Well, my statements about students and academic matters are over. I only wish to make a brief comment. Quds Day is close. This year, I believe that Quds Day is different from previous years. Both in previous Ramadan and in this Ramadan, the Palestinians made and are making great sacrifices, and the Zionist regime is really showing abject maliciousness and committing all sorts of crimes. It is very hard to imagine a greater degree of crimes and maliciousness. They're doing whatever they can, and the US and the Europeans are supporting it. Palestine is both oppressed and powerful. It is an oppressed power. Once, many years ago, I used the same description for the Islamic Republic. I said that the Islamic Republic is like the commander of the faithful, who was strong and powerful, but at the same time oppressed. Today, Palestine is the same. It is really powerful. The Palestinian youth do not let the Palestinian cause be consigned to oblivion. They are standing firm against the enemy's transgression and crimes. Quds Day is a good opportunity for expressing our support and unanimity with the oppressed people of Palestine, for boosting their morale and for increasing their power so that they will be able to show their presence in these arenas. Of course, Islamic governments are very passive in this regard. They are acting in a very bad way. One should work much harder and speak much more for the Palestinian cause. Not only do they not take any action, but they're also not even willing to speak. They do not make any valuable comment to the advantage of the people of Palestine. If we think that the way to help the Palestinians is to establish relations with the Zionist regime, this is a very grave mistake. 40 years ago, the Egyptians made this mistake. Egypt and Jordan established relations with the Zionist regime. But did the Zionist crimes decrease in the past 40 years? No. On the contrary, they increased tenfold.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
The conversation with the Iranians will be much about two critical points. One, enrichment. As you mentioned, they do not need to enrich past 3.67%. In some circumstances, they're at 60%. In other circumstances, 20%. That cannot be. And you do not need to run, as they claim, a civil nuclear program where you're enriching past 3.67%. Verification will be the key point that undergirds this this agreement, if we're fortunate enough to get there. And we're going to have very tight verification.
This is about a nuclear monopoly that Israel enjoys in the region. No one in the region other than Israel can be permitted to have a nuclear weapon. That's what this is about. Israel has over 300 weapons, immense destructive power, that can be launched from air, missile, or sea. No one in the region has any nuclear weapons. And what everyone in the region knows is that you must not have any, because having any threatens Israel. Now, what are we talking about with Israel? Well, we're talking about something much more than the defense of Israel. The defense of Israel went out the window back over a year ago when this event on the 7th of October, and we've talked about that before. I am absolutely skeptical of the notion that this was something that happened without the Israelis knowing about it and reacting to it. Complete nonsense. They're too confident, and they had that place under excellent surveillance. I don't believe that for a minute. But the narrative is we were attacked on 7 October, and this horrific attack is now justification for us to effectively dominate the whole region, because we in Israel will not be safe until everyone is subjugated. That means that only Israel can have a nuclear weapon. So that's really the heart of the whole issue. Now, when you turn to Iran, the Iranians had agreements with us based upon what the Biden administration had done. Well, President Trump, in response to his the Israel lobby's support for him the last time around, said, I'm going to cancel it. And, of course, there were great cheers in Israel. Cancel the arrangement that is essentially imparted stability and security to this nuclear development in Iran. Everybody was very happy. Now we're back to where we were before. We're exactly as you pointed out. President Trump is somebody who privately does not want a war. There's no question about that. However, he's talked himself into a corner, Dan. And unless the stipulations are accepted and the Israelis effectively are willing to bow down and go along with Israel, you're still going to get a war. And I think, unfortunately, the betting is still heavily on Mr. Netanyahu's side. He's still in charge. He has to approve. And if he doesn't approve this arrangement that we come back with, that Mr. Witkoff is putting together on behalf of President Trump and ultimately Israel, then I think you get a war. Because in the final analysis, is everyone in the region prepared to live under Israeli hegemony? Because that's the message.
And do you think the others in the region are willing to do anything to prevent an Israeli hegemony, or will they just live with whatever happens?
I think there is already being a lot of evidence for the emergence of an alliance across the region against Israel and us. We try every chance we get to try and undermine and divide that. We always have some measure of success with the United Arab Emirates, with the Saudis, others in the Gulf that are not very strong societies and have very weak militaries, when we can persuade them to attack, say, a group like the Houthis. You remember there was a war between Saudi Arabia and the so-called Houthis, people in Yemen, for a very long time. And a lot of Americans were shocked to discover that the Saudis were actually supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS against the Houthis. And people were wondering, why are we bombing these people if they're, you know, against the very same people that have caused so much destruction and murder across the region? So you still have these kinds of contradictions. But I would say today that Egypt and Iran are very much of the same mind. They see all the agreements having been violated by the Israelis. They want to trust us, but they don't know that they can. You have the Russians and the Chinese on the outside and others that are members of BRICS that are saying, we'll back you because you're vital to the global economy and you're part of our system, if you will, called BRICS. And then, of course, the Turks. And the Turks have always been the 500-pound gorilla in the corner, and thus far Mr. Erdogan has tamed the gorilla. But how much longer can Mr. Erdogan tame the gorilla? Because the gorilla may turn around and remove him. There's that much anger, frustration, and ferocity in Turkey right now directed at Israel and us. And again, we've been talking about this for years. This is simply built to the point where now it's truly explosive.
But so there's one thing that is a bit puzzling to me, is that, okay, Israel wants to have hegemony. And for the most part, they have it right now. They don't even have to gain it. They already have it. But they have made Iran the boogeyman for so long that they just have this insatiable desire to quell them. And yet, this whole, ever since the 10-7 and all the things were Israel basically systematically eviscerated Hamas, Hezbollah, weakened again the Houthis, if not quelled any of them full outright, they did. And it showed that Iran was completely powerless to do anything about it. I mean, what nation on the planet can have their embassy destroyed in another country and to have an assassination in their capital city on an inauguration and not go to war with somebody? Yet that's exactly what Iran didn't do, because they don't have the power to do it. So that should tell you.
That's a fundamentally false statement.
Which part?
False. They don't have the power to go to war. You haven't looked carefully at Iran. Iran's arsenal of missiles is enormous. It could flatten Israel in a day. They have the power to go to war. They have chosen repeatedly to avoid war. And I've said this 1,000 times. No one in the Middle East is interested in a war except Israel and the United States. That's it. There's no one else in the region that wants a war. Everyone is going to go to great lengths to avoid a war, not because of Israel, but because of us. The Iranians don't want to go to war with us. The Iranians have been trying for 30 years to change their relationship with the United States, to build a rapport economically, socially, politically with the United States. So don't make the mistake of assuming because someone has opted not to do something, they can't. The real question at this stage is, what's the incentive for them to continue to do nothing, particularly when they're told that the only way they can satisfy us, potentially, based upon Mr. Netanyahu's demands, is to turn themselves into Libya. And we all know what happened in Libya.
Right. Yeah. Not a good situation to cite if you want them to accomplish it. But
don't assume this weakness. I mean, people said the same things about the Russians. You know, the Russians went through years of humiliation at our hands as we advanced NATO further and further east and continued to treat the Russians as though they were irrelevant and created all sorts of utterly false reasons to embargo them and hurt them and harm them, particularly under Biden and his predecessors. None of this is new. Does that mean that the Russians don't have the power to go to war against us or anybody else? Well, obviously, the answer is no. They have the power. They have not wanted to go to war. It strikes me right now that if you look at the rest of the world, the only two powers in the world today that don't seem to appreciate the catastrophic consequences of a real war are the United States and Israel.
Yeah, and so I'll accept your statements there. I didn't even mean to imply that Iran was weak and incapable of doing that, only that whether diplomatically, politically, or militarily, that they have not wanted to go to war and that they showed restraint with all those attacks that we would never show because they don't want to go to conflict. And with that being demonstrated, there should be no reason for Iran, Israel, and the United States to still press so hard to try to fight the casus belli to destroy them. So the question is, what is the driving imperative to destroy Iran and destroy all this stuff when they're already safe from Iran?
Well, they don't think they are. And if you make any attempt to persuade the Israelis that they can live with the Iranians, they will reject you. They just won't listen to you. So the Netanyahu position is really the position of the Israelis and their agents here in the United States, who are heavily involved in our government and heavily involved in pushing for war in the Middle East. Their view is that Israel will not be safe until this regime is destroyed. That's why you've listened to people talk about the strategy behind the strikes that are coming, if there is, quote unquote, a war. The strikes will focus on not only trying to destroy the nuclear facilities where they try to develop a weapon, in theory, they also want to destroy the regime. And this is where you get these statements from the President of the United States. This will be a bombing on a scale the world has never seen. You know, all this sort of marketing language that the President uses, he is a marketing genius and he tends to rely heavily on hyperbole. So I think that's the view from Mr. Netanyahu. Either they're dead and gone and buried, or they have a new puppet regime obedient to their will in Washington's, or they have to go away.
So
and they're running into problems, by the way, big problems right now with the Turks. And yeah. The Israelis, there are very smart Israelis over there that know just how dangerous the Turks are. But there are many that keep dismissing them. Oh, you know, they can't do it economically. They don't have enough money. Their economy isn't that strong. Their society is this. The Israelis do what we do. We tend to impute to others our value system. And tragically, Dan, we've adopted the Israeli value system, which is everything's about money. Everything's about luxury. Everything's about living in a high prosperity environment. They don't understand, and we don't understand, that there are people out there willing to sacrifice what we think is so important on the grounds that their civilization, their culture, their nation must survive. And that means they must fight. So my point is that there are many in the Israeli general staff that understand just how serious and dangerous the Turks are. But again, everything comes down to us. Will we support the Israelis? And they're convinced that with enough air and missile power, and maybe some special operations power in limited numbers, that they can control events and what happens in the region. I don't agree with them. I think it's a very dangerous position to take, but that's the thinking.
That's what I wanted to ask you in the last bit of time we have here. In the event that Trump is not able to restrain the dogs of war, and we end up taking action jointly with Israel or however it turns out, what is the prospect, or better question, how would you see things playing out? Because unless you go in with this big ground force of 500,000 troops or something and literally take over the country, a bunch of bombs and missiles is not going to cause regime collapse. It's going to cause pain. But then, as you pointed out, there's also missiles that are going to be coming back this direction. And then there's the issue of Russia, who relies on a military issue with Iran for its drones. And then China, who has relations with both BRICS and the oil from Iran. Will they both just sit by passively and let this Israeli-U.S. force destroy Iran?
Well, remember, for the Russians in particular, and I think to some extent the Chinese, they view what is likely to happen to Iran as something that inevitably will visit them. In other words, they see us as this rogue regime that's determined to retain and expand our military hegemony across the world. So if they stand by and watch Iran pulverized out of existence, then they'll think to themselves, we're next. And remember, they don't want a regime in Tehran that is going to open the floodgates to enemies that can come up through the Caucasus and enter Russia from the soft underbelly, which is Central Asia. I mean, one of the reasons the Russians are very happy to have a good relationship with the Chinese is that they don't want to be invaded again by people in Central Asia. Now, we laugh at such a thing, but it's a very serious problem in Russia. One of the reasons that Putin has bent over backwards to cultivate good relations inside Russia with its Muslim population. They have very, very large numbers of Muslims, over 20 million of them. Most of them are of Turkic origin. Why do they want good relations with them? Because they know that if they should become hostile to Russia, that could open the gates to invasion from the south. And that invasion comes up through Iran, down through the Caucasus, and into Russia. Remember, during World War II, the Soviets moved most of their industry that they could into Siberia, beyond the range of German aircraft and bombers. Well, that was only possible because Central Asia was secure. It was only possible because Iran was secure. Why was Iran secure? Because we and the British negotiated an agreement so that we could ship supplies to Russia through Iran. Iran is strategically vital to Russia. That's why Russia won't stand by and do nothing, which means if we unleash this mother of all strike strategies, which I guess is what the president is saying, we're going to be at war with a lot more than Iran. And it may not be straightforward at first. It may not be overwhelming at first. But it will grow, and it will become a very, very serious and dangerous challenge to us. And we may lose everything in the Middle East as a result. That's something that people in Washington don't do. They never ask the question, we have to measure what we might gain by what we might lose. If you ask that question, You do not go to war with Russia and Eastern Europe. You do not go to war with Iran today. There's too much at stake for us. But we're not thinking in those terms, and we have no strategy. There is no strategic thinking in Washington at all. What I just outlined to you, I'm trying to give you an appreciation for what the Russians think, because they do think strategically. They act accordingly. There is a rational strategic calculus involved. That's why they went into Ukraine. We don't seem to have any. What we have are impulses. Yeah. One impulse today, a different impulse tomorrow, and everybody is hanging on every word from Donald Trump because he's seen as the man who verbally makes policy.
Well, I hope that we at least somebody starts asking those questions before any bombs are dropped, because there is so much to lose and almost nothing to gain.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله. الله يا الله والحمد لله. الله ولا اله
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and what we do in this program is to listen to certain viewpoints of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and then try to shed light and explain some precious points in their view. Well, about the role of leaders in faith, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, the leader must not only possess faith but also embody it, guiding the people towards a virtuous life and the realization of justice. Well, the quotation from Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi underscores a fundamental principle in Islamic leadership, particularly from the Shia perspective, which emphasizes the integral relationship between faith, morality, and social justice. In Shia Islam, a leader is not merely a political figure, but a moral guide whose faith is reflected in their actions and policies. This responsibility is rooted in the belief that leaders are accountable not just to their constituents, but also to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The Holy Book of Quran emphasizes the importance of righteous leadership in several verses. For instance, in Surah Al-Baqarah, verse number 251, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala states, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ If it had not been for God's favor upon some of them, he would have destroyed them. You see, this highlights the divine support for those who strive to uphold justice and morality. Furthermore, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam is quoted saying, the leaders of people are their servants. This reinforces the idea that true leadership involves selflessness and dedication to the welfare of the community. And in Shia, we have the Imams, and particularly Imam Ali alayhi salam, who exemplifies this ideal. Imam Ali's governance in Kufa is often cited as a model of just leadership, where he prioritized the needs of the disenfranchised and he upheld justice, even against his own interests. Imam Ali alayhi salam's famous saying is, people are slaves of the world, and as long as they do not experience the trials of faith, they will remain loyal to the religion. And it reflects the necessity for leaders to inspire the people towards a higher moral standard. So Imam Khomeini's assertion that leaders must embody faith is a call for leaders to be moral exemplars, guiding their communities towards virtue and justice. In this framework, faith is not a passive belief, but a dynamic force that shapes actions and policies for the greater good. Okay, well, dear listeners, that was the time we had for this episode of Spring of the Truth. For ending, let's just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about the role of leaders in faith. He said, the leader must not only possess faith, but also embody it, guiding the people towards a virtuous life and the realization of justice. Thank you very much for listening to us. I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say.
There was a spring of truth, a selection of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints.
Never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
Palestine declassified.
I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we expose the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be exposing how Microsoft collaborates with Israel and how it's deeply embroiled in the Gaza genocide. In our first report, Latif Abu Chakra catalogues the scale of Microsoft cooperation with the Zionist entity.
Moroccan Ibtihal Abu Saad stirred global headlines when she stood up to challenge Microsoft AI CEO Mustafa Suleiman about the company allowing Israel to use its AI in the Gaza genocide. While the AI factor has had widespread media attention, it's also important to know the ways in which Microsoft has been vital to the Israeli occupation forces historically. Jonathan Jacobson's Highfield Capital has over 31 million shares in Microsoft. Jacobson is chairman of Israel's Institute for National Security Studies and a trustee of Birthright Israel Foundation. He is also a funder of Settlements and the Friends of the IDF. Microsoft has acquired several Israeli tech companies founded by alumni of the Israeli military: Arawato, Adalim, Hexadite, and CyberX, which were all developed by Israeli military figures. Microsoft also previously invested in Israeli company AnyVision, which is involved in facial recognition of Palestinians for the occupation. Microsoft also collaborates with both Elbit Systems and Israeli aerospace industries by providing Xbox controllers for use in Israeli tanks. Microsoft even dispatched mentors to an Israeli military hackathon that lasted 24 hours, during which software experts and cadets worked together to form creative solutions for military operations. According to the Israeli military, it can identify its enemies and control robots and drones with gestures, thanks to the Microsoft HoloLens, a mixed reality device. Microsoft's computer infrastructure has also proved very useful to the Israeli Air Force and Army. The firm assisted the Israeli Army's officer training base, Bahad 1, in developing an app that gives soldiers access to the Israeli military protocols, history of victories, and code of ethics. Additionally, Microsoft assisted with the administration of the Israeli military's civilian human resources database, which keeps tabs on the Army's reserve soldiers. Microsoft is also vital to the operations of the Israeli police. It provides the cloud services to the police, which secures classified information. Israeli police also use body cameras made by Taser, a key Microsoft partner. All of this is part of what Microsoft describes as connected policing. In a brochure describing this arrangement, the firm asserts that its software helps Israeli police intelligence officers complete data searches in seconds. Microsoft is an essential component in the genocide of Palestine.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. And the American human rights lawyer and author, Dan Kovalik, joins us once again as our guest contributor today. Dan is a prominent dissident voice against the vilification of other countries that's then used by the US as justification for punitive sanctions and even military intervention. Dan says he feels compelled to write about matters of public concern, which is why his books cover human rights and US foreign policy. His latest book, The Case for Palestine, was published last year. Welcome to the show. David, what do you make of the stand taken by that former Microsoft employee who was mentioned in the film just there?
Well, it was very brave, wasn't it? I mean, she went right up to the front of the podium, and she was, of course, then hustled away by security staff. This is what we need to be seeing in companies like Microsoft, and indeed many, many other tech companies. The staff themselves, the people who work there, need to be refusing to take part in their activities which are helping to continue the genocide. And it needs to be replicated all over the place. I mean, in the US, in the UK, in Europe, and everywhere else that these companies are operating. And I think it's really important that we start to move to a way of operating against those who support the genocide, which is material, which actually stops them from doing what they're doing, in a way that Palestine Action have been doing. We've been seeing that on the show on many occasions.
Yeah, she certainly set the standard there, but it takes real guts, doesn't it, to stand up like that?
Yeah, well, it does, and then of course you face the consequences, and those consequences aren't always fantastic, but people have to do that. You know, nothing is going to be won without sacrifices made by our side.
And we're seeing other brave actions being taken by organisations like Palestine Action, which also takes real guts, doesn't it, to stand up in that way. But Dan, what was the reaction like to this in the United States?
You know, it's been muted. Certainly the mainstream press is very much covering for the genocide in Gaza, covering for Israel, covering for the companies supporting Israel. So there's been little reaction, is the truth, except amongst the alternative media, social media.
Well, David, I mean, the Palestinian resistance even issued a statement in support of that former Microsoft employee, didn't they? I mean, what was the significance of that, would you say?
Well, it's significant in the sense that they've specifically mentioned it, but it's also in the context of the statements they have been making, calling for people all over the world to take action directly against the occupation and against the genocide. And what they're trying to say is that actually the rest of the world needs to do more. We've done what we can. We're doing more. There are, of course, ongoing resistance attacks, which we've heard about in the last a few weeks since the ending of the ceasefire, unilaterally by the Israelis. But the people that are saying that people in West Asia, in Arab countries and Muslim countries, but all over the world, need to take action and take a stand. And it's important that the level of action against the genocide is raised across the world.
Yes, indeed. And I think it's encouraging, though, isn't it, that we are seeing people really rallying to the call to actually, you know, make a stand. And we're talking about, you know, it takes real guts to do it. But increasingly, people are willing to actually, you know, take that stand, aren't they?
People are increasingly willing to do it because they can see that the the main forms of action that have been taken in solidarity, so-called solidarity with Palestine, is mass demonstrations, which are not going to work, which are not going to convince the Western governments, the Germany and the UK and the US, the main three main Western governments supporting the genocide, to stop. What has to happen is that there has to be a material action to actually get in the way of the imperialist war machine, and that means, of course, including attacking companies like Microsoft and other companies like it, and also, of course, the arms industry, the arms companies, which are the ones which are supplying the bullets and the quadcopters and the technology and the drones, which are actually, on a daily basis, killing children in Gaza.
And ironically, of course, it's thanks to the big tech companies, in a way, that increasingly more and more people are aware of the atrocities, the horrors that are actually being perpetrated by the Zionist entity.
Well, it's the contradiction, isn't it? I mean, they couldn't do the kind of genocide that they're doing without the tech companies, and we wouldn't know about it, partly because of the results, which is that we have access to social media, even although, of course, it's massively censored and the algorithms are manipulated to favour the Israelis.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dan, I mean, Microsoft owns Skype, as you know, which has been banning Palestinians in Gaza from using the platform and has kicked other Palestinians living abroad out of their accounts without warning. I mean, how deep do you think this goes?
Yes, I mean, really, it breaks my heart. You know, I know many Palestinians in Gaza, and being able to communicate with the outside world is really critical to them. It's a salve, you know, for what they're suffering. And they depend on it to not only communicate with family, which is obviously very important, but also to be able to ask for money, which, believe it or not, is still important in Gaza. Things are very expensive. And again, they're cut off from the outside world a lot of the time anyway, because the electricity's been cut off. For weeks, Gaza, I think is it 7 weeks? Gaza has not had food, medicine, other goods coming in, electricity coming in, water. So they are cut off from the world. And to cut them off, you know, additionally in this way is really cruel. And it shows how much the, frankly, ruling class is beholden to Israel.
Well, David, I mean, Jonathan Jacobson was simultaneously a shareholder in Microsoft at the same time as being chairman of the Institute for National Security Studies that's affiliated with Tel Aviv University. I mean, what do you know about this Israeli think tank?
Well, it's a think tank, isn't it, in occupied Palestine. As you say, it's affiliated with a university. Yeah. But it's essentially part of the national security apparatus of the Zionist entity, very, very close to the intelligence services, to the Shin Bet, the Mossad, and indeed to the occupation forces, the IOF. So this is part of the war machine. And so you have someone who's part of the war machine at the same time as having massive shareholding in Microsoft, and of course also you know, helping to support other Zionist activities like Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, and of course various other, like, for example, the Birthright organization, which, you know, convinces young kids that they have a birthright to come and steal Palestinian land, you know, fundamentally racist ideology. So this is all part of the widespread Zionist movement, which straddles the whole globe, and where people have myriad different sorts of conflicts of interest, if you like. So part of a think tank in Tel Aviv, at the same time as owning shares in a tech company and involved with other Zionist organizations in the US and other places.
Mm. Yeah, as we've said on many occasions, in spite of their best endeavors, they are losing the battle for public opinion around the world, aren't they?
Well, they are. They've lost that battle. But what's important, of course, is their ability to carry on killing people. Mm. And that, of course, depends on Microsoft and it depends on the arms. And so what the opposition has to do is to interfere with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, Dan, I mean, can this relationship between Microsoft and Israel actually be challenged meaningfully then, do you think?
I mean, I think if consumers react to this by refusing to use Microsoft products, by refusing to buy Microsoft products, and of course it could change.
Well, our next report examines the indispensability of Microsoft to the Zionist entity's efforts to subjugate the Palestinian people.
The overlaps of Microsoft with Israel are legion. In fact, it could be said that the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian land, body and mind, could simply not be possible without Microsoft. The big tech firm provides its cloud service for an Israeli app which tracks Palestinians called Al-Munasek, the coordinator in Arabic. It is used by the Israeli civil administration in the West Bank to deal with permits for work, commerce, family visits, and medical status.